Hey there.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How's it going? We should introduce ourselves. I'm Rich Lowry with National Review.
I'm Noam Shriver at the New Republic.
So, how's it going down there? Are you in Washington?
I am in Washington. I'm a little checked out. I'm actually on book leave. So, I'm working in the office, but I'm not really seeing anybody in the office or talking to anybody in the office.
Are you allowed to say what your book is?
Yeah, it's kind of a narrative of the Obama administration economic team, starting with the transition and working through their responses to the various crises.
I thought that might be the first Bob Woodward book, but he went with the war.
I was very relieved.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Very relieved. Yes, I was really rooting for him to just kind of continue in the foreign policy trajectory.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was
because the first Clinton one he did, maybe it was everything that he did, but it was at least overwhelmingly.
Oh no, yeah,
I remember it.
That was my nightmare. Yeah, that we'd have the agenda part two, and we did not. So or at least not yet. Anyway, well, why
it's
don't
good,
we?
Good for you too, because I think the domestic stuff is more interesting. Although we're in the midst of a foreign policy time at the moment.
That's right. Well, why don't we jump in? What's your sense of how it's been going in Libya, what Obama's been doing, and where we're headed?
Well, it's been very nerve-wracking as a reluctant supporter of this intervention. It's been maddening at times, and I don't know whether that's just a lack of realism on my part in terms of the juggling you have to do to keep a coalition together and just the inherent military difficulties on the ground. Apparently this latest episode where the rebels were pushed almost all the way back to where they had started when we began this intervention, part of the reason for that was just bad weather over 3 days, so maybe I should just be more cognizant of practical considerations like that. But it's just, I assume Gaddafi's gonna go, and that we won't stop until he does go, but it is an assumption, and we may have a mismatch between means and ends there, and I certainly think we're gonna have a mismatch between means and ends when it comes to the ultimate humanitarian rationale of this intervention. Because we learned in Iraq, you can have a dictator sitting on a society in the most brutal way possible, and then when you get him to go, it's like picking up a rock in the middle of a stream where the rock looks pretty ugly, from the top, and then you look what's underneath it, and it's even worse.
Right.
And you can just sort of let the lid off on all sorts of terrible forces, and I fear that's what we may see in Libya, and we will be even much less prepared to deal with it than we were in Iraq, because you need troops, lots of troops on the ground. We had them in Iraq, but not in sufficient numbers, and they weren't doing the right things until 2007. You need to have an intimate knowledge of the social and political realities on the ground. We thought we had some of that going into Iraq. We really had almost none, and it took us years and years of blood, sweat, and tears on the ground to gain that knowledge. And you need a plan, and we didn't have much of a plan going into Iraq, or at least we planned for the wrong things. We have no plan going into Libya. So this war, to me, looks as though if it succeeds in the goal of ousting Gaddafi, it will end up being a 21st century-style punitive expedition, in effect, against the Gaddafi family, wrapped in a lot of humanitarian rhetoric, with a lot of liberal support, with the blessing of the UN. But the things that you would do to actually improve the society and make it better governed afterwards, we seem to have very little interest in and very little preparation for. Now, I'm okay with that, because the reason I basically support the war is just to get rid of Gaddafi, because I think he's a menace and has American blood up to his elbows. But I'm a little mystified why liberals, so many kind of liberal hawks are back to supporting something like that, including some of your colleagues at the New Republic.
Yeah, so a lot of interesting thoughts there. One sort of macro thing, but and a small thing before I get into that. I found it very interesting that the president, in trying to define the difference between Libya and Iraq, talked about how the difference here is we're not going to actively topple Gaddafi the way we did Saddam in Iraq. And the reason is because if we did that, then we would own it. And I kind of think we own it anyway, you know. So I was, and all of the thing, you know, all of the consequences that follow from that you described. So I do think maybe liberals and people on the left have this, I won't call it a delusion, but are sort of reassured in ways that they shouldn't be, because they imagine there to be differences procedurally with Iraq that maybe exist but don't matter. So that is interesting to me. On the macro point, I guess I would back up. I don't know that I believe that we're in this until he's gone, and that's my biggest concern, I think. I mean, for the obvious reasons that, you know, if he stays and we go, then we've only deferred the scenario we were trying to avert, which is the massacre of lots of people in the East in particular, but just generally. And then, you know, we have a guy with a long history of you know, terrorist acts, who's really pissed off at us. So that's not good. And just generally, an ability to sort of stir trouble in the region. So I think it probably, you know, it should be the policy to get rid of them. I'm just not convinced that we're going to do that, partly because of the distinction that the administration is trying to draw with Iraq, partly because, you know, because of the, you know, in order to really ensure that it happens, you probably do need a stronger commitment of whatever it is, troops or arming rebels or training rebels. And I just don't know that public opinion is there. I don't know that we're going to have an appetite among, you know, domestically to do what it takes, particularly with Iraq and Afghanistan still going. So I kind of, when I think about whether this is a good idea and whether I support it, I would love to see him go, but I evaluate it from the assumption that he won't necessarily go. And then I sort of try to think, well, is it a good idea even then? And it's a very close call to me. I mean, I do think it was sort of noble and, you know, heroic to try to avert this massacre in Benghazi, which was clearly going to happen. But if he doesn't end up going, I think you have to weigh two considerations. One is what we end up doing is just deferring sort of a massacre and a lot of bad stuff, which is bad because not only have we not stopped it, but we've taken a hit to our credibility because we sort of said we were going to stop it and then we didn't. And we've indicated, you know, say to the Taliban in Afghanistan that you can just sort of wait us out, and we don't really mean to finish jobs that we start. So that's bad. But the plus side, I guess, is had we not gone in, we would have said to everyone in the region, if you're like Mubarak and you go peacefully, you know, you lose your regime, but if you react with kind of murderous force, then you get to stay and it's fine. And so we've, even if he doesn't end up going, we've like dramatically increased the cost of that. You know, he's lost a lot of valuable assets, and it's generally probably not been a good couple weeks for him. A lot of defections. It's costly. You know, even if he doesn't end up going, we've really increased the cost, and that has, I think, some strategic implications for how the Arab Spring plays out. So I kind of come at it sort of assuming that he might not go, and trying to evaluate whether it was nonetheless a good idea. And it's just a really close call for me. Those two things are very close. So I kind of agonize and go back and forth.
Yeah, well, it is a very close choice and an agonizing one. If he doesn't go, you know, I think it'll be clearly worse for our prestige than having just warned him and having him ignore us.
Right.
I thought would have been bad for our prestige, but this will be worse. But it will probably be worse for Gaddafi because he'll lose. I would assume part of his country, and
right.
I think unless we suffer a catastrophic collapse here, which I don't totally rule out, but I think we would at least save the eastern part of the country for his from his clutches, and then you'd be engaged in a longer game to try to topple him over the longer term. But I just wonder, you know, how sustainable is a partition? Is it much harder than it looks? Because it's just hard to draw a line in the sand and defend those cities in the east. Can he just send, you know, disguised to civilians as terrorists or as snipers? But my bottom line is, again, I think he'll he'll go, because I'm still a kind of believer in the Milosevic scenario, that this is will be a version of Kosovo, a war with, you know, entirely from the air, with no congressional authorization,
yeah.
tenuous public support, a president whose commitment is questionable at times. But at the end of the day, you're dealing with a very primitive military that you can just degrade and degrade and degrade until it just can't take it anymore. But after that, I'm just not optimistic. I really have a hard time seeing how we're going to avoid elements of his regime and his supporters becoming an insurgency.
Right.
And it's very hard to see who you're going to hand over to. This transitional national council sounds great,
right.
but is a very ramshackle operation. So it seems as though you can have a vacuum in of authority a police presence to kind of prevent or keep down an insurgency. So I think the best case scenario for me is Gaddafi is gone, but even then I think it's going to be a heck of a mess.
Right. No, I agree. A mess seems like the most likely scenario. Just to back up a step, though, I mean, how confident are you that, you know, we can even maintain a no-fly zone in the east indefinitely? I mean, when we did this stuff in Iraq, you know, in the 90s, that was obviously before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's sort of low cost in relative terms, but, you know, on top of a lot of other stuff, a lot of other commitments, and with public appetite pretty low at this point, it's not nothing. Particularly if you have the occasional mechanical failure or whatever, a plane just falls out of the sky, and you know, and you get to highlight the hundreds of millions of dollars that particular plane costs, and you know, these never make for good headlines, and you just have that stuff over periods of months, you know, when you do these kind of engagements. Go ahead.
I would assume we'll just hand it over to the British and French, which we're already doing.
Right.
I mean, we're even handing over the air campaign to them now, so it'd be a question of how much willpower they have to sustain it, which is questionable.
Yeah.
Although they were more gung ho about this thing than we were, which doesn't mean that they can't turn around and dump it themselves.
Well, I think we have consensus here that it's ugly going forward. What's your sense of, before we move on, maybe just a quick dive into what's going through Obama's head? I mean, what's your sense of his instincts? Some kind of, you know, he obviously sort of, I can't remember if he explicitly disavowed the existence of a doctrine or all but explicitly disavowed the existence of a doctrine, but it reminded me of sort of the Bush v. Gore Supreme Court decision where, you know, they basically said, don't look at this as a president of any kind, you know, this is a one-off thing.
Yeah.
Has he evolved at all? Are we seeing the kind of true Obama on this stuff? What is the true Obama on these kinds of engagements? What's your sense? I have some ideas of my own, but
I tend to think that he's right when he says there isn't a doctor, and I think the circumstances and the reasoning here are so carefully tailored for exactly this circumstance that you really can't apply it anywhere else.
Right.
You know, how often are you going to have an intervention where you can act relatively quickly, which only took one French airstrike to initially save Benghazi, and where you're going to have the whole world more or less braying for you to do this, you know, people in the region, the Arab League, the Gulf Council, and the Europeans out in, ahead of you wanting to do it, where there's very little military risk. We had a plane go down, there may be other incidents, but in the scheme of things, you know, it's not anything like Iraq and Afghanistan, and where there's someone you can immediately hand things off to. It just seems to me, I'm not sure any of that applied to any of the interventions that we didn't do, you know, that everyone is so ashamed of.
Right.
You know, under this doctrine, you still wouldn't do Rwanda, I assume, or Sudan.
Right.
So, yes, I don't think there's a doctrine. And to the extent there is one, it seems to me more ruling out interventions than ruling them in.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, what struck me, and it may be a similar way of, or a slightly different way of getting to the same place, is just the overwhelming emphasis on procedure and proceduralism, which I think is very Obama. You know, he's a guy who has enormous faith in process and comes close. So I don't, you know, at times maybe even says that if the kind of you get the process right, the outcome is right. You know, the procedural kind of justice is justice. And I do think that is a kind of, you know, I mean, in this case, it worked out, but I do think you're right, that it's very difficult to imagine a lot of other places where the process would kind of come together like this, in which case the question is, like, well, what happens when the mission is right but the process is wrong, you know? And I think we still don't know where he comes out on that, you know? It seemed like enough of a kind of struggle, you know, justifiably. I mean, I agonize over this stuff too, so I don't mean to trivialize the calculus here. But I think we still don't know what, you know, in this case, you just had a nice convergence of process and procedural considerations and sort of absolute considerations. And I just, you know, in the future, it's very easy, as you say, to imagine them diverging. And I don't know how he's going to play.
Well, a big thing in my mind as well is just how sincere he is about the process. Because when he says, the goal of our military operation is not to topple Gaddafi, and everyone else says that, I assume that's total nonsense.
Right.
You know, of course it's in furtherance of that goal, and I hope it is.
Right.
But I think it's still unclear whether that's true or not. Whether this is kind of diplomatic dodginess in furtherance of his ultimate goal, or whether he's sincere in putting the UN mandate and the demands of the coalition ahead of what is his ultimate goal.
Right. No, I think that's right. We may see here, you know, in this case, actually, when all the stars align, they don't actually align that way, and we do see this divergence. So, I think that's right. I think it's, look, at some point he's just going to have to make a choice, whether the process is more important than the goal or vice versa. And I think we just don't know where he comes out on that,
Just one last point on Libya that irritates me a little bit. I think the stakes in Libya are much smaller than Iraq. Our risks are much smaller than Iraq. We can screw it up in all sorts of ways, and it's not going to matter or hurt the way Iraq did. But we're not going to pay the kind of cost we did in Iraq. But to me, the idea that this was, which we heard initially when Obama went in, about how careful he was and how he waited to line things up, I just think it's total nonsense. He just acted right at the end when he's just faced with the stark choice, let Benghazi go and let Gaddafi roll over these people or not. And he picked not. I think that was the right choice.
Right.
That was the choice I made. I was very reluctant about this the whole time. But it was just too much to watch that happen.
Right.
And then it was kind of trying to get the pieces in place in a mad scramble after that. So for me, all the weight was not a process of careful deliberation. It was a process of indecision, and at the end, just not having any choice.
I think there's a lot to that, though. I do think that my understanding is that they kind of proceeded on a bit of a parallel track. They had Susan Rice sort of start laying the groundwork on a kind of parallel track in the weeks before, and I think it was just kind of see what you can get at the UN. So in the event that we need to go this route, I'd kind of quibble that it was completely completely on the fly. But you know, in terms of gaming it out sort of strategically, I mean, again, that's sort of more of a procedural thing. Anyway, well, maybe we should move on to the domestic side of things too.
We got a shutdown to cover here.
That's right. Yeah.
A looming shutdown.
So what's your sense? I mean, I guess the big question, right, is I mean, maybe I think it's a big question because I'm on the other side of the spectrum, and you have a big question for Obama. But I see the big question as Boehner. You know, he's got this huge force on his right, you know, a huge amount of pressure, where a lot of Tea Partiers and freshmen in the House just want him to show some backbone and at least fight for the full $61 billion in cuts. And then, you know, he's got this, you know, probably very legitimate anxiety that, you know, the White House obviously can't go for that. They can't go for that and the riders. And so the result of just being a complete hardliner will be a shutdown, and a shutdown, the CW is, though you may disagree with it, is bad for Republicans. So, you know, it's kind of a pick your poison. And you know, and if he makes a deal, you know, he has to worry about defections and maybe an overthrow at some point. So, I mean, I guess it seems like a kind of a pick your poison moment for Boehner. I mean, maybe you disagree. Maybe you think the onus is kind of on the White House and it's a pick your poison moment for them. But I sort of feel like they've gone as far as they can in making compromises, more or less. I mean, a couple billion here or there they could probably do. But there's certain some of these riders they can't really do, and they can't go all the way up to $61 billion or really that close to it. So it seems like the White House is kind of maxed out on what it's prepared to do and what it can do. But Boehner kind of has to make a decision at this point.
Yeah, he's in a tough spot. It wouldn't surprise me if there's a shutdown. I haven't worked the Hill much over the last 2 days, but that's just the way it seems. Because although I think the Democrats have notionally come pretty far the Republicans' way. I mean, that top line number of 33 is bigger than the original Ryan number of 28. And for me, I'd be curious what you think about this. The amazing dog that hasn't barked, to use the cliche in this debate, is you know, I thought the 28 from Ryan's pretty ambitious in the scheme of things as far as cutting things goes, because it's so hard. And then when they doubled it, I just thought, okay, I admire that sentiment, and I hope this works, but it's going to give them, the other side, so many targets. And it just, that counterattack hasn't really been mounted, or if it has, no one's really noticed, and I don't know whether it's that there's distractions with so much else going on, you know, Wisconsin and whatnot, or whether in this fiscal environment, maybe those sort of attacks, they just don't have the same kind of purchase they used to. But anyway, that's a broad point. I would think they're still far away, though, because you got the distance between the two numbers, 33 and 61. Then you have, how are you going to get those numbers, right? Because Republicans are really want to have actual cuts and actual programs, and feel as though the Democrats are getting there to their number through smoke and mirrors. Then you have the riders, which there isn't agreement on. So those are still three pretty big disagreements, and there is, I think, among Democrats, you see this most obviously with Chuck Schumer, or with Howard Dean, who just said it out loud. There's a calculation that shutdown's going to be good for them, which I think is a fairly reasonable calculation, unless they're too blatant about it. And there are freshmen who just think, you know, they're there to change things, and you can't, you know, if you're going to cut $61 billion in an environment with a deficit this high, it's still just a drop in the bucket, so you might as well go all the way and get that, and there's no reason to compromise on something that's a drop in the bucket in the scheme of things. So I think you have both sides there for different reasons heading towards a shutdown.
Yeah, I agree. It seems really, even again, unless, you know, I guess the counter argument is that Boehner decides, look, no matter what I do, there's going to be an insurgency on my right. You know, it's just that we're clearly not getting $61 billion, and you know, we're not getting $61 billion in the riders, and the government is going to be shut down indefinitely, right? So something is going to, at some point, there's going to be a deal, and the government's going to run, and it's not going to be with all $61 billion and the riders, and that means that a lot of Tea Party people are going to be upset, right? So at some point, Boehner's going to take some flack. And so, you know, maybe he could tell himself, well, I'm going to take flack anyway. Nothing but the absolute maximalist position is going to satisfy my base, or the, you know, the base of my caucus. And so I might as well just avert what I think would be a political disaster for the party generally, which is the shutdown, and make the deal and take my lumps. I don't think he's going to do that. I mean, I kind of get the sense that you do, that he, and my colleague John Shade made this point too, that maybe you know, all flack is not equal for Boehner. You know, maybe it does diffuse things a bit if he has a brief shutdown and can say, look, we tried, we towed the line, we took it as far as we could take it, we fought the good fight, and now we have to make a deal. You know, maybe that's better. He'll still have some defections and a lot of upset people in his caucus, but it's better than kind of caving from their perspective at the outset without even, you know, firing a shot. I'm sure it makes 14 metaphors. But, but you get the idea. I don't know. My sense is that Maynard does think he has to at least make a showing. You know, he can't fold right from the beginning. Though it's ironic because, as you say, I mean, the terms of the debate have so far shifted in the GOP's direction. It is shocking to me that he wouldn't get more credit for that in any kind of. In any just world, he would, yeah. I guess. Your point about the White House, I think this is the, and just kind of going on the offensive about this stuff, to me, personally, and I think to a lot of people on the left and Democrats, it's the single most mystifying slash frustrating thing about the White House, is just not an inability. They certainly are able, and they're very good when they decide to. But an unwillingness to sort of play hardball at times, and to kind of be the mature grown up that's going for a deal when the other side appears to be playing, you know, hardball. And I think there are a lot of opportunities, as you say. And I think. I think a Rahm Emanuel type, certainly he was very good at doing this in the 90s, and I think his impulse, say, you know, during the healthcare debate was that. And so you had a bit of a tension. I thought, you know, maybe a healthy tension in the first 2 years of the Obama administration with a Rahm type kind of arguing at times for a more scorched earth approach, and Obama himself and some of Obama's other aides thinking you have to be sort of the grown-up and bipartisan. And I think now maybe with Daley replacing Rahm, I think maybe we're too skewed in the other, you know, the conciliatory impulse. We're too stacked up on personnel who have the conciliatory impulse. So I do agree with you. I think it's a source of frustration for people on the left. I think it dates back for a while. I mean, it dates back to healthcare, even the stimulus. People would argue, you know, that they could have been more aggressive. But I think the big thing that is kind of standing out in the minds of people on the left is the Bush tax cut, where a lot of people thought they should just fight this. They had more leverage than they realized that they had. They should just threaten to let all the tax cuts expire and accuse the GOP of wanting to just, you know, just raise everybody's taxes in order to protect tax cuts for millionaires. You know, Obama had one moment in 2009, in September, I guess, I think it was, he did this speech in Cleveland where he used the line, "I'm holding hostage, you know, middle class tax cuts for rich people's tax cuts," basically. And you know, Boehner had his famous kind of sort of temporary crumple where it looked like he was going to cave. And so I think the left, people on the left saw that and thought, wow, you know, if it was that easy, why don't we play hardball all the time? And yet, instead, Obama, you know, they didn't do that. They kind of shelved the Bush tax cut debate until after the election. And, you know, probably got a good deal, but I think people on the left thought at too high a cost, they could have probably gotten a similar deal without the concessions on the estate tax. Anyway, suffice it to say, there is a long lingering suspicion of the Obama White House, which I think is unfair in some spots, but on target in other spots, that they are too quick to be conciliatory, too quick to compromise. And even if you're going to compromise, don't start there. You know, start with a hard line opening position and then compromise behind closed doors. So I do think this, you have to understand this from the perspective of the left against this broader narrative of frustration that's sort of been building, you know, about why they can't just take a more scorched earth approach when that's the way the GOP plays it often to a very good effect.
You know, and you can, Bill Clinton proved you can do both.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, he sat down with Gingrich and Armey and actually, you know, did cut some deals, but the whole time he was softening them up,
yeah.
You know, by attacking their discretionary cuts and especially, of course, their entitlement cuts. And it's just shocks me that piece has been missing so far. And my big takeaway on this CR debate is just it's not that important. I mean,
yeah.
Another $30 billion in discretionary spending is just not future. Doesn't make a big difference for the future of the country. And even these writers, I assume, a lot of conservatives, unfortunately, out in the country, are a little bit misinformed about
yeah.
them. They hear about defunding NPR and Planned
right.
Parenthood and defunding Obamacare, and they assume that forevermore these things will
right.
be cut off from federal funding.
Right.
Well, it's just a temporary measure for 6 months, almost. just symbolism. So right. it just doesn't seem to me worth the risk of a shutdown. You don't know which way it's going to bounce. It's probably going to bounce against Republicans, just because, you know, people instinctively want to believe Democrats are soft on defense. They instinctively want to believe, you know, Republicans are pro-corporate, and they're just instinctively going to believe when Democrats and some folks in the media make the charge that Republicans have forced this and welcomed it, they're going to believe it. And there actually may be some Republicans out there saying, yes, we welcome this.
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, the other thing to me is the media template. You know, the second the government shuts down, what does every media organization in America do? They cue the footage of 95, right? Which everybody knows. You know, I mean, I say that sort of in quotes, right? But everybody knows played badly for Republicans and for Gingrich. So if everybody knows it, and that's the CW, and then, you know, regardless of where the country is now, you know, even if public opinion, I would dispute this, but even, you know, you could argue that public opinion is more receptive to cuts now. But if you have, you know, the first several days of coverage just queuing the footage from 95 where this plays so disastrously for the Republicans, and why are they driving the bus off the cliff again? I mean, that can't but shape, you know, public perceptions of how this is going to play this time.
Yeah, and my belief is that the debate over the debt limit is much more consequential, and they have much more leverage in that because people are so instinctively against raising the debt limit. I think it makes pairing it with some sort of serious spending restraint sound quite reasonable, mm-hmm. and Republicans could get some serious spending restraint there, which I think politically is very important for a couple of reasons. One of which, you know, if it was just tossing out random ideas, you know, if you had a total budget freeze for 5 years in there or something like that, then Senate Democrats have to meet that number as well, and it just limits their ability to demagogue Republicans. And, you know, the other highly consequential thing we obviously have coming out next week or so is this Paul Ryan budget, which is also a much more important fight than discretionary spending the rest of this fiscal year.
Right. I mean, you mentioned kind of a certain, you know, miscomprehension among conservatives in the country. I mean, it's a question worth exploring a bit more. I mean, how much do you think that kind of the average Tea Partier or, you know, sort of energized conservative voter understands that, you know, the money just isn't in, I mean, A, the money isn't in discretionary spending, B, there is a little over 10 years, but there's certainly not much this year or next year, right? Like, if you take any one year, a couple tens of billions of dollars in discretionary spending, it's not very meaningful one way or the other. And yet, there's this fetishization of these figures. I mean, do you think the average sort of Tea Partier sort of understands just the kind of broad contours of the budget and where the money is and where the action is?
I'm not sure whether anyone in the public understands it, or very few people.
But the rest of the public isn't that as exercised about it, right? I mean, the Tea Partiers, it's like their raison d'etre, supposedly.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it depends. I mean, a lot of these people are very, very, very plugged in. But, you know, one of the interesting things that's gone on since we've had this new Congress is, and this we've written about this, others have written about this, is these Paul Ryan education sessions for the freshman Republicans, who basically ran on implicitly on the misconception you're talking about, where they said, you know, we really have to balance the budget, and suggested more or less we're going to do it waste, fraud, and abuse, ending the bailouts, cutting the stimulus. And when they're asked about the Ryan plan, would mumble and look at their shoes and deny wanting to do anything with entitlements, and actually would attack Obamacare for cutting Medicare. And then you have them show up in Washington, and you have Ryan say, actually, look, guys, let me show you this chart, this pie chart.
Right.
And if you're really serious about dealing with the budget, you're going to have to deal with entitlements. And that's part of the reason that the Ryan budget is going to deal with entitlements, and what is will be an extraordinary act of political courage, I believe, on the part of House Republicans. We'll see where it goes.
I agree. I'll believe it when I see it too. I still think we're going to get some amount of that looking down at your shoes thing. But Ryan, give him credit. He's forced the issue. I mean, I think his numbers are a little dodgy. You know, I mean, the savings that he anticipates getting over, you know, 75 years or whatever seem you know, slightly dodgy to me, particularly for someone who thinks that the anticipated savings in the Affordable Care Act won't materialize over the next 10 years. You know, the idea that, that Congress is going to enact these cuts, much larger cuts over a period of 75 years, seems dubious to me. But I do give him credit for putting a target on himself and saying, look, I'm the guy who at least will tell you where the action is, where the spending is, and we'll be honest about the fact that we have to do something about it. So I do give him credit for that.
It'll be an extraordinary thing if they come out of this okay in my mind, and I hope they do, but you just look, it depends on how you ask the question. All polling's a little bit different, but you know, people oppose cutting Medicare by 2-1.
Yeah.
And your colleague Bill Galston, I know you've been in book writing mode, so haven't been able to read every single piece on the TNR.com, but had a...
I read everything on TNR.com.
Okay. Just for the record, let that be known.
That's right, exactly. Yeah,
as you know, right. He had a piece the other day actually arguing that President Obama should, instead of taking kind of the obvious Clinton route and savaging Paul Ryan and Republicans over this, should actually say, oh, these are very interesting ideas and the basis for a serious discussion, and then try to meet them halfway. And Galston's argument is you can have two big issues in the election, one the economy, the other debt. The economy, probably the best of circumstances, is not going to be that great, so you want to limit your vulnerability on the debt, and you do that by undertaking or attempting some serious bipartisan compromise on entitlements.
Yeah, I'm not really moved by that, but it has a logic, just not one that I subscribe to. Look, the one thing I will say is, if you want to go kind of scorched earth on this stuff, like Clinton did in '96 with the Medicare, Medicaid attacks, which were very effective, I think, and really wrapped that stuff around Dole's neck and Gingrich. By association, you do have to have a certain kind of bloodlust, right? You have to be pretty ruthless. And so, if you know, getting back to the previous point, if you know your instinct and your comfort zone is to not be as aggressive as you need to be on that, then maybe you need to think of an alternative strategy, and that would be one. But I think the high percentage move would be not that. It would be, hope that we get this acceleration, or at least the last 3 months of job growth continues basically linearly through next summer or fall, and then put yourself forward as the protector of the benefits that people have come to love and or at least rely on. I never understood how how just kind of limiting by that calculus, it's like you don't have a great economy, so that's a negative, and then you limit your losses on this other issue that's bad for you. So like, what's the positive, right? Like, where do your votes come from? I see where you hold down losses among certain people, but where do the actual votes come from? It just seems tricky for me to imagine that.
So let's say he takes he takes up your preference on this stuff politically, and it works. He gets reelected. Then what's the play fiscally? How do you deal with this problem, if at all, or do you consider it not a problem?
I do consider it a problem. I am not convinced that there is a solution before some kind of crisis moment, because I don't really see... I mean, look, part of this, again, we may have different views on this just because of where we sit, but I just think things have to happen on the right before a conversation is even really possible. And some of those things are kind of sort of starting to happen, like with this Tom Coburn, Grover Norquist back and forth over whether, even something as seemingly reasonable as eliminating tax expenditures, wasteful tax expenditures, which you would think in principle conservatives would be in favor of, is okay, or you should just be completely, jihadi on tax increases, and even eliminating a wasteful tax expenditure isn't a good idea. So I think in order for us to get to the point where we can kind of have a grand bargain on stuff, I think I think there needs to be movement on the right, and then we can talk about then we can talk about what we do with Medicare and to a far lesser extent Social Security. But I just think we're not in a place yet where it's worth having a conversation, just because the constraints on people on the right, even if they wanted to engage and broker compromise, are so powerful that it would be pointless, and you would have to go so far in that direction to even start the conversation that it wouldn't be worth having. Now, I think you can make a very fair point, which is surely not going to advance that cause by wrapping the stuff around their neck in the 2012 election. If you're trying to figure out how to make the ground a little more fertile, that won't do it. But I think we're so far from fertile ground that it seems like a pretty marginal cost at this point.
Yeah. Well, my hope is Ryan presents this budget, and I think he'll be able to ably defend it. And the question is whether his caucus will be able to ably defend it. All the people who aren't as well informed on this stuff as he is, which means just about everyone.
Yeah.
But just not present it and not get run over, live to tell the tale, and have a presidential candidate take it up, win in 2012, and then my theory is you can have an era of conservative reform in 12 and 13 as bold as the and shameless, you might say, as the Democrats just had in 9 and 10. So for me, everything is a prelude to 2012, and kind of everything depends on that. And everything that helps in making that case in advance of the 2012 election is good. Everything that hurts is bad.
Well, since you raised 2012, maybe now would be the time to segue into that. When my colleagues and I talk about the field in the GOP side, there was a little of this in 2008, but I think it's even more pronounced now. We sort of go through all the 6 or 8 or 10 candidates, and basically you do the candidate by candidate analysis, and you conclude that no one can win, which is a mathematical impossibility because someone clearly is going to win. But it's amazing. Everyone seems to have these just mortal flaws. So then you have to kind of go through again and say, well, whose is like the least mortal, right? I have an idea about where that gets you, but I'm curious where you...
Does that get you to Tim Pawlenty?
I think it does, yeah. I mean, I read Ramesh Panuru's piece, which I found, mostly compelling, and my colleague John Chait has been arguing this too. I guess I do think that Pawlenty is the least flawed candidate, though he has fairly large flaws. But I think that is where it gets you. Do you disagree?
A couple things. One, I totally agree about the same feeling as 2008. And the one thing to remember about that experience is John McCain had no plausible path to the nomination.
Right.
He had an implausible path to the nomination. He still got there.
Yeah.
And I think that should be some comfort for Mitt Romney.
Right.
But what Romney has to worry about is if he's the front runner, he's certainly not a giant killer, even at this stage, and no one started running ads against him on healthcare.
Right.
So, there's a big vulnerability there. But... is it more of a vulnerability than McCain had on immigration, which literally destroyed his campaign for some period? It's just that he rose from the dead. Pawlenty was a very impressive guy. I think he's the least offensive to all aspects of the party. But obviously the question is whether you can excite people. And I think on paper, the guy who has the least flaws, working your way down to that guy works, but does it actually work on caucus night, and does it actually work in terms of motivating people and getting them out there to vote for you? And that remains to be seen. And one hesitation I have with Pawlenty over the last several months is just he sounds so tinny when he's doing the pitchfork Pawlenty thing, playing to these audiences in a way that's somewhat insulting.
Yeah, no, I agree. He's not been good so far trying to kind of calibrate the message.
And then Newt, he just as flawed as a vehicle for the personal reasons we've heard a lot about. And then just temperamentally, although I have so much respect for him because he is a brilliant guy. He'd be brilliant, you know, as a conservative intellectual. As a politician, you know, he's an Einstein among politicians. I mean, he's just an extraordinary guy, but he just is not the steadiest or most solid character, and we saw it with the Libya thing.
Yeah.
Which to have someone do that in the middle of a general election campaign would be an utter nightmare.
Right.
And unfortunately, Newt gives the sense he's all too capable of that, and I don't know how he can overcome that. But the upside of Newt, though, at the same time, though, he's been around forever. He's a former Speaker of the House. He should be the most establishment figure you can imagine, yet he still feels very boyish and still feels anti-establishmentarian, which is a key thing, you know, in this political environment on the right. And then, you know, someone inevitably is going to, I'm leaving aside Daniels, I assume he's not going to run. Haley, I still wouldn't be shocked if he pulls up short, although he's obviously been very seriously doing the things he needs to prepare to run. But then we'll have someone, you know, from the bucket that everyone discounts or no one's thinking about, you know, a la Huckabee last time, who emerges and becomes a very serious figure unexpectedly.
Who are the candidates for that? I always, you know, these conversations invariably sort of lead there, and you know that universe better than I do. Who are the kind of the people who are kind of toiling away at the gubernatorial level or whatever and have interesting ideas and you know, some charisma that could plausibly step in to a vacuum on the GOP side?
Well, I'm not sure whether any of the people we think about are going to do it. I mean, the most obvious is Chris Christie.
Right.
We had him in here about a month ago, and he's just very honest, saying he doesn't feel that he's ready and feels he's still growing every day. No pun intended, as governor, and has never felt over his head as governor and wouldn't want to step into a situation where he does feel over his head. So I would give that, you know, like a 1% chance.
Yeah.
I'm thinking more, you know, the people who have some interest that everyone discounts, that suddenly the night after Iowa might look much more serious.
Right.
You know, that's exactly what happened with Huckabee. So you have Michelle Bachmann, who's going to be very strong in Iowa if she runs. Who knows, you know, a Rick Santorum. A Rand Paul, you know, which I discount because he's been in the, you know, Senate all 3 weeks.
Right.
But if you're ambitious and shrewd and you kind of pick up a part of the party that's not really represented by anyone else, you know, this kind of this libertarian tendency that extends to overseas interventions.
But the GOP elders, you know, such as they are never going to let Michelle Bachmann or Rand Paul be the nominee. Come on, this strikes me as wildly implausible. You know, I mean, I think they could scramble the field certainly, but the idea of Michelle Bachmann as the guy that pick your you know, Ron Kaufman is raising money for or something in the summer of 2012 just seems absurdly implausible to me.
No, I would not think she'll win the nomination, but you know, she could win Iowa. The point is there's always some dark horse who emerges, and that's the case in almost any field, but it's especially the case, I would think, this year, where you the establishment candidates look very weak when it's a volatile political environment generally, and when you have this very strong grassroots movement that doesn't want to play by the usual rules in the form of the Tea Party. So I just throw that out. That's my big hesitation about handicapping the field. It's kind of the big black swan.
So two thoughts here. One, on Plenty, I completely agree with you. I think he's been bad so far, and you do have to worry about people who sort of look good on paper. But, you know, I mean, just a kind of small example of this, I think, last time around was, you know, Brownback looked like a guy who wasn't going to win the nomination but looked like he could do really well in Iowa, right? I mean, in neighboring state and had the appeal to social conservatives, but he was flat and went nowhere, and it just fizzled out. So I completely agree with you about that. I mean, I do think, you know, notwithstanding the fact that the neighboring state thing didn't really help Brownback, I do think Pawlenty will benefit somewhat from that. I do think also that he actually, and Ramesh says this in the piece, I've sort of seen him up close a little too, I think he actually is pretty good kind of retail. You know, he's good with people. He's got a kind of natural charm about him, an easy way about him with people, much more so than Romney, who's like like the opposite, right?
Yeah.
And I think so I think the combination of the two by being very close means he can spend a ton. I mean, he can just basically live in Iowa for the next whatever it is, 9 months, 8 months, and I guess 9 months, and just kind of let that natural ease and natural charm work to his advantage, and do a lot of these small venues, and build up an organization sort of organically, which could really pay dividends on caucus night. So I think he would not have a chance if not for some favorable confluence of geography with his own strengths. And then I think, if Pawlenty were to win Iowa, I can't imagine, everyone sort of assumes that New Hampshire would be the sort of bulwark for Romney, but I got to think there are a lot of, conservatives and Tea Parties in New Hampshire who aren't in love with Romney / Obamacare, who, if someone caught fire in Iowa, would defect fairly quickly. So then I think, the pieces kind of start to fall into place. But, it's a huge if there, and, as you say, these things can seem to work on paper, and you just never get any traction. I agree with you that Pawlenty's been bad. He was really bad at that Iowa forum. Even, I thought, just his physical appearance, he looked like that Martin Short character, Ed Grimley, it felt like the suit was too small for him or something, and his hair was, mashed down. It just was not, a larger than life. He was smaller than life, not larger than life. I thought he just looked physically very bad. One other question for you. So I have this sort of pet conspiracy theory, which is there is no universe to me in which Haley Barbour is a plausible presidential candidate. I mean, just nothing. There's nothing you can say that will convince me that this guy is a plausible candidate, from his physical appearance to his draw to his, kind of checkered racial past, to his lobbying career. There's just, to his just, being a consummate GOP insider, even the lobbying stuff aside, there's nothing, I think that this guy has going for him, other than the fact that a lot of people owe him from over the years, and so they don't want to disabuse him of this fact. So sure, we'll cut you the check, Haley, whatever, it's more like insurance, than anything else. So my pet theory is this, and I got to thinking about it when the theory, so that's one kind of premise. The other is, if I can do that math, surely smart GOP operatives can do that math, right? And so the question is, then why are they going to work for him, right? He's had a couple of impressive hires, and then he picked up that woman, the top political aide to Jeb in Florida, which struck me as very mystifying. And so when I put those things together, I come up with a conspiracy theory, which is Jeb wants Haley to be the nominee in 2012 to assure GOP loss, which then allows Jeb to run in an open election in 2016. I know you're going to say this is crazy. It's just sweaty.
You're getting your Donald Trump on.
Exactly. But really, I mean, is that less plausible than Haley Barbour as the GOP nominee? I don't think it is, actually. Please tell me where I'm wrong, as Bill O'Reilly would say.
I think there are two things you probably, given where you are, underappreciate about Haley Barbour. One, people really like him. Really, really like him. He's such a character and a warm personality, and he lights up a room. Just people enjoy the guy. And two, they're just anyone who's worked with him on practical politics is just hugely impressed with him because he's a hugely talented guy. So I think those things are much more likely factors here than the theory. I agree, as a vessel, in a lot of ways he's deeply flawed. And I was struck by his interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday a month or so ago, which just was a terrible interview, just a terrible performance by Haley. And you could just see that if he were advising someone else on, how to go on a Sunday show like this and tout his candidacy, he'd give them genius advice. But
right.
The problem is, with trying to come up with that advice for himself, given his inherent flaws, is just and really difficult. I mean, yeah. He comes up with the line, okay, yeah, I was a lobbyist, but what's the president of the United States,
terrible.
If not
terrible.
The most powerful lobbyist in the world? You know, so it's
terrible.
Like from Haley Barbara Griffin to president of the United States is a natural step.
Right, exactly.
So I think I haven't seen him.
President or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I haven't seen him use that lately. But I think Haley is pretty clear-eyed, and I think he's aware of some of the problems you mentioned, and that's why it wouldn't surprise me that he doesn't, if he doesn't get in at the end. But on the other hand, you know, we just talked about how weak the field is. So if you're an ambitious guy of a certain age and this is your shot at it, you know, why not? And as far as Jeb goes, I just think he... if he wants to be president of the United States, he has to run this time,
yeah.
And he's not going to do it. And 2016, maybe Obama will be reelected. Yeah, haven't been governor, you know, in 8, 10 years, whatever it is. And then you'll have this crop of new Republicans from this time around,
Marco
all of whom, for all of whom it's too early now, except for maybe Rand Paul, you know, ready to go. So I think Jeb may be just missing his opportunity.
Yeah.
But we should. But before we finish here, I know you want to engage in cruel and heartless attacks against my beloved New York Yankees.
Yes. Yeah. I don't have the most sophisticated argument against the Yankees. The argument basically boils down to one point, which is that the Yankees are evil. So I know it's there have been more sophisticated arguments made. So I guess I could elaborate on it just a little bit, which is. Look, I understand that there are a lot of teams, a lot of Major League Baseball teams, who basically, can just buy, you know, we basically have a two-tiered, you know, system, right, where the Minnesotas and the Milwaukees and the Kansas Cities, serve as the sort of minor league teams to, you know, they produce talent and then the Yankees of the league buy them up and pay top dollar and whisk them away from their middle market franchises. And so I understand that the Yankees aren't the only ones who do that. Obviously, Boston does it. If you look at the Phillies, I mean, their staff is preposterous, right? It's ridiculous to have those four pitchers, only one of whom came up through the Phillies farm system. So I understand that it's a critique that could be applied much more broadly. My problem with the Yankees, I guess, is that it's both Yankees management and Yankees fans, and really it kind of leaches into just other people's perceptions of baseball and other fans' perception of what's going on. Is this sort of assumption that basically the Yankees are it's the sort of default assumption that the Yankees will the best, most talented. Free agent who's likely to command the highest price, that person, the default assumption is that they are going to the Yankees the following year. And Cliff Lee was kind of that person this offseason. Obviously, he didn't end up going there. But again, it's the sort of ethos, this idea, this sense of sort of entitlement that it would, you know, that is just where you go if you're the sort of A-Rod or the Cliff Lee of a free agent class. And it's that kind of sensibility that I find evil, basically.
You're kind of George W. Bushian on this.
That's right. I mean, again, you know, Boston ends up with these guys sometimes, but, you know, if you talk to Boston fans, they have this kind of complex, you know, well, you know, we never kind of do as well with this stuff, and we'll be lucky if we pry one away. But whereas the Yankee fans are just like, yeah, that person's going to be a Yankee next year. That's just how it is.
What's Boston's payroll this year, by the way?
No, I don't know. I suspect it's as large or larger. I mean, they certainly made, you know, Adrian Gonzalez and Carl Crawford. I mean, they did more. They were more active in the offseason than the Yankees, certainly. So, again, it's not. I'm not arguing facts here with you on some level. I'm arguing sensibility. You know.
Yeah. I'll respond here. Well, first of all, I think there's obviously a lot to what you say, and I think the Yankees are much less likable than they used to be. And for me, well, I grew up a Yankees fan because my dad's from New York, even though I was raised in Washington. There's just no other alternative. I was weaned on the Yankees. My most prized possession as a kid was a Yankees hat he brought back from New York.
And I do make an exception for people who are sort of born into the creed. So I don't consider you completely evil.
The teams, and I really don't see how, once someone gets beyond their irrational hatreds and animus, how someone could not admire and even like the Yankee teams of the mid-1990s, you know, because it was the balance of the team, was raised, you know, from the farm system, the core of the team, Jorge Posada, Derek Jeter, Rivera, Andy Pettit, Bernie Williams, you know, that's kind of the spine of the team right down the middle of the field. And those are homegrown guys. They're classy. Paul O'Neill, not homegrown, but, you know, they got him in a trade. And it was just a hard-nosed, gritty player. And that was kind of the character of that team. And for me, the end of those Yankees, more or less, even though a number of those guys are still around, was when they signed Jason Giambi, who is a classic kind of acquisition that you're complaining about. You know, and this guy who had no character whatsoever, at least, you know, kind of baseball character in the same way, you know, was abusing steroids and was just sort of, you know, flown in from Oakland.
Right.
So, and I think the team now has more of that cast than I would like. Most obvious examples, you know, Teixeira, A-Rod, and CC Sabathia, but there's still, you know, some homegrown talent there. You know, Robinson Cano, Brett Gardner, Jeter still, Posada still, although he's going to DH. But, you know, I see what you're saying, and I used to be an extreme Yankee defender, and just like, you know, this is capitalism, guys. They have a more effective franchise and a bigger market, and they invest in the team, and just get over it. But the NHL-NFL model is becoming a little bit more attractive to me. I will say this, though. You can in baseball, you can buy basically a playoff spot.
Right.
You know, if you spend
except if you're the Mets.
One of the top spenders in the league, you can usually assure yourself that, but you cannot, I know from hard experience here, you cannot buy yourself a championship.
I think that's right, yeah. And, you know, and I just read it. I mean, the Mets show that you can't even buy a playoff spot at times, you know. So,
not necessarily.
So there is something to be said for, you know, managing the budget you have, you know, which they clearly, you know, did effectively. I mean, I do agree with you that they sort of jumped the shark at some point kind of in the late 90s, early, you know, maybe early 2000s. And you know, particularly with, I just think with, you know, with the, some of the pitching acquisitions, you know, the Carl Pavano and Burnett,
these
guys that were just, you know, these were like Mets style acquisitions. They really were. And I think at some point they just got less discriminate. You know, this ethos that I'm talking about almost came back to just kind of blew up in their face because they would kind of indiscriminately grab these guys who had, you know, Vasquez last year was sort of like this, you know, who had great years the year before without kind of figuring out and thinking through how they were going to fit into the organization and fit into the staff and what they, you know, how they play in Yankee Stadium. And they did, it would just kind of snatch these guys up. So I do think they almost kind of got what they deserved by just shifting too far in that direction.
Well, and that's why they're so terrible in the 80s as well. In the 70s, teams were you know, more carefully crafted with indigenous Yankees or smart trades, although there was a free agent here and there, you know, Reggie and Catfish Hunter and whatnot.
Right. So. Good. Well, they started off the season well from your perspective, right? So you're
that's right. 6-3 victory against the Tigers.
Good. Well, we shall see. I'm sure we'll be rooting in diametrically opposed directions all year, but that's how
yeah, I find just one last baseball thought. I sadly find myself a little less of a baseball fan than I used to. Well, I've gotten more into hockey, so, you know, that goes into June, so it just leeches in. There's only so much bandwidth I can spend on sports. But also, I just think baseball, you know, I don't relish going to baseball games anymore. They're so long, and I have a series of reforms that all my traditionalist friends, you know, hate, but I think there should be laser strike zones. I think there should be instant replays. I think there should be a series of measures to crack down on any delay of the game to speed it up. I mean, any game, no matter how beautiful and subtle it is, is no game is worth watching for 3 hours.
It's interesting. I'm of two minds of this. I mean, I do like the sort of languorous, you know, summer afternoon. There's something about just kind of the rhythm of it, or whatever the baseball mystics, you know, whatever words they invoke, I agree with them, you know. Sort of scaled up over 162 game season, it's too much. I agree with you. I mean, you know, it's fine in late July when I have an afternoon to kill, but you know, I can't really do it more than a couple times a year for precisely that reason. So I guess I do agree with you. And I've actually tried to make myself into a hockey fan, not because of the length and my frustration with the game, but my frustration with not having a franchise to root for. I was born in New York, and I come from a family of anti-Yankees, so I rooted for the Mets as a kid, but was so disgusted with that franchise and the terrible management, general management, the Bobby Bonilla, Vince Coleman era, that I just sort of disavowed my Mets fandom and, have lived in D.C. for the last 10, 11 years and tried to make myself into a local sports fan, but have been frustrated at every turn, basically.
Well, you got a great hockey. That's my hockey.
I know. Well, exactly. So I've been trying to make myself into a hockey fan with mixed success, but it looks more attractive with every passing year here. So yeah, that may be the way of the future.
If any sports fan, I think, should at least enjoy playoff hockey.
That's
so
right.
Hopefully you'll have a good long batch of it here coming up.
Well, looking forward to taking a look. Great.
All right. Well, very nice talking to you.
Likewise.
Good luck with the book.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Take care.